Talk given Friday, 24th January, 1975. In connection with the living of the religious life, let us consider one or two points very carefully. There are outstanding problems which face all human beings. One is the problem of violence in life. Violence in the world, outside us, violence within our own minds and hearts, in reaction to the violence of the world, or because of the frustration of our desires and our ambitions. You know how it is. Right from childhood, we like to be somebody. We want to achieve something. It is the assertion of separate egohood. It is the assertion of self-valuation, which demands fulfillment and recognition. And if this doesn't come about, and the family or friends, the world says you are a failure, there is tremendous violence roused up in our nature against it. We may outwardly suppress it because we have been conditioned to be according to the social codes of civilized nations by our religious teachings. Be meek, be humble, be gentle, be forbearing, and all the rest of it. But the fact remains that inside ourselves we have never looked into this desire to be somebody, to achieve something. We have never got to the root of the matter and discovered how to deal with something fundamental in ourselves, which, if we once really understood, would dissolve at root this passion to be somebody. And of course, we react with violence, therefore. And we react, as I said earlier, if we meet with any sort of frustration in relationships with other human beings, in love, and in so many different ways. And in our own day and age, when violence is spreading like a plague all over the world, all over the world, we are carried along by this psychical stream of violence. We are almost drowning in it. And we find it so difficult to remain calm and peaceful, feeling friendly towards the world. Now, these are quite serious problems. They are always related to the fundamental problem of the manner in which we are aware of ourselves and the world. We are conscious of ourselves very vividly, and all the rest of the world we call the not self, not me. This is our fundamental error. And it's an error which cannot be righted by mere logic, by mere intellectual perception, or by any sort of conditioning from outside. It is deeply ingrained in us. And it becomes such a problem because we approach it, broadly speaking, in one of two ways. Either we fight against it, or we try to run away from it. Neither way will work. Supposing, for instance, I've got a crooked nose. Wasn't there a character, Cyrano de Bergerac or some such gentleman, who had a very crooked nose? Well, now, all right, I have a crooked nose. I can't fight against it. I can't run away from it. It comes with me wheresoever I go. Like Mary's little lamb, which came in with their tails behind them. Lambs which came in with their tails behind them. I don't know if it was Mary or all the little lambs came in with their tails. But they can't get away from them. They are there. So, if we wake up to that as a fact with sufficient depth, then we get to that other state, which is also an error. We just accept it, as we say. But mere acceptance or mere resignation to one's difficulties, to one's sorrows, frustrations, failures, doesn't really heal the psyche. Because underlying that mere acceptance is the desire. The desire is still alive, although it is frustrated. It is this desire in itself and what it stems from which we have to understand wholly. an understanding in the religious context means that we have to be totally involved with it, and we have to completely absorb it into our very being. This absorption into our being is the great difficulty. It's something which the human race is not capable of doing under normal circumstances. Under ordinary circumstances, I should say. When the human race is really human, it'll be the natural thing. We will absorb whatsoever comes our way and absorb it with complete understanding. Intelligence, well awake, will see the truth of the thing as it is. And when one sees the truth of the thing as it is, one very wonderful factor is present. There is no selfness, no self-orientedness involved in the seeing of the truth. Insofar as there is selfness or self-orientedness involved in any observation, our observation is faulty. We do not see the truth of it. We see, at least in part, that which we wish to see, which we like to see. In other words, we are imposing our predilections upon that which we are trying to examine. Can't do it that way. That way one doesn't see the whole truth. And if one doesn't see the truth as the complete truth, then there is no healing. There is no resolution, no true resolution of the discord. The streams of life are dammed up somewhere. So you see, at the back of acceptance and resignation lies this canker of desire. We have given up the struggle, as we call it. Now most people will say, right ho, I see that. I will fight against the thing. You see how the mind immediately jumps ambivalently to the other dual. Whatsoever I fight against, I strengthen. If I don't strengthen it, and if, as appears on the surface, I am destroying it, lock, stock and barrel, all I'm doing is reforming it into a totally different shape. It has another life. You see, there is no such thing as destruction or death in the sense of complete annihilation. There is only a changing. If you study the scriptures carefully, you will find that in the major religions of the world, the devil is never completely slain or wiped out. Look at the book of Revelation, for instance. For 1,000 years he's shut up, then he's let loose again. What does this mean? If you look at the Zarathustrian writings, you will find that Ahriman, the evil spirit, is ultimately redeemed by the good spirit, the good mind. But even so, there is no guarantee that there will not be an opposing force. Opposing forces characterize all existence. The method of conflict, or the method of running away, or the method of spineless resignation or acceptance, doesn't work in bringing about true harmony, which means, therefore, life abundant. It is only understanding in this profound sense. You see all sides of the thing, and you can see all sides of the thing if selfness is out. If personal desire is out, you might ask, what is in that case? Vision. Vision. And with vision, there is love. And because there is vision and love, vision you may equate, if you like, with wisdom. Because there are these two. Come to maturity. There is this understanding which enables you completely to absorb the whole situation into your own psyche, into your own mind. And because your psyche is pure and strong, it heals that sick thing which was the outward problem. Let us not regard all this as, oh, it's an interesting philosophy. Let us not say, oh, I wish I could do it. Every one of us can do it. Every one of us does do it in some measure or other somewhere. That is one reason why we survive at all. If the forces of death, of destruction, overbalanced the forces of life, of construction, we'd die. That's all. So the fact remains that there is something in us which already fulfills something of this. Consider how the one who loves takes, for example, a real parent with his or her, or his and her child. How does the mother just have this magical understanding of the infant's needs? It's a curious phenomenon. Somehow the mother knows. All nature displays it. But in human beings, much of that which takes place inevitably, unconsciously in nature has to become an awareness, a live, real awareness. And because you and I as human beings have this capacity to look within and light up in awareness from within, this love becomes a real flame of healing, of light, directed by you, the individual person, to that which needs your love. And it has to be love. Not just an emotion, not just possessiveness, nothing to do with desire of any sort. This is the very, very difficult part. Of any sort. Nothing to do with all that. But this mystery, this magic, which is love, which is actually the creative pulse of the universe, of life, come to self-consciousness inside you. This is love. That is manifest through you, and then you really love. And it is that which makes whole, which heals. Your problem is not solved. There is a complete resolution of the discord. It goes on. A problem really means my lack of understanding. Not mere intellectual perception. That is part of the story, of course. That is indispensable. It's part of the story. But my lack of understanding, this harmony of wisdom and love, which enables me to take the whole thing right into myself, selfness is absent, isolative self-consciousness doesn't function at all, and the right thing is done. It happens. You and I try to solve problems. Transcendence produces harmony, the resolution, because of its creative activity. When, through any one of us, such a resolution, such a harmonizing takes place, it is not I or you, the individual, the separate person who has done it, but the totality, through you, the finite, separate self, has done it. All the religions are at one in this. Unto God the glory. Not mine, but thine, O Lord. But as long as O Lord is conceived by me as another, the thing never happens. I and the Father are one. Never forget. So you see the implications of it. Take a business. John Smith and Son. The two are one. They are one corporate body doing a business. So too, I and the Father are one, in actual fact. I have to wake up to the reality of that fact. And as I wake up to the reality of that fact, all separate I-hood, separate I-ness is out of the picture. Completely out. Then there are no more problems, as we might say, of being selfish or unselfish and all the rest of it. Just try and feel out very intensely now, each one of us. Supposing I was truly selfless, would I be concerned whether I am a failure or a success in life? How utterly meaningless the words become. Would I be concerned that so-and-so is not treating me rightly? That so-and-so is no longer in harmony with me, no longer loves me, loves somebody else or something like that? You see, I would naturally cease to be conscious of the situation in that fashion. Any problem, as we call it, is most intimately related to the manner in which I am conscious of the situation. If I am conscious of the situation as thus and thus, I say that, oh, it's a terrible thing. But if I am aware of the situation and I see, really see open-eyed, the whole situation as a totality, with no selfness, no imposition of personal desire or demand on it, it's quite different. Instead of me suffering at the hands of another, I am all the time helping helping that other and giving him or her the power to become harmonious. It's very difficult to do, of course, because it's so easy to forget. We are overpowered all the time with lapses of memory, right memory, forgetfulness. Oh, I forgot myself. Oh, I failed to do this. I couldn't keep it in mind. That's the whole point. Forgetfulness is the most terrible devil, the most successful devil against us. And he lives right inside our brains. Forgetfulness. He has a vast place in the brain, the forgettery. So you see how we have to approach if we can make the right approach. Then sorrow and dis-ease, the absence of ease, the absence of true comfort, the state of strength, then vanishes. That absence vanishes. Now this is very important, because insofar as we ourselves, within ourselves, are whole and healthy, strong, comfortable, not comfortable in the worldly sense, in this psychological and spiritual sense, the pure psyche and the clear seeing mind, seeing the truth, if we are comfortable in that sense, then what applies to the world today, this terrible state of violence, is something which we can heal, actually. Have you not noticed how the presence of a person influences the group? Take a school teacher with the children at school in his class. Or it may be adults. Nowadays, most adults are regaining their second child, the charm of their second childhood, by taking adult courses and all the rest of it. Take the right sort of man at a board meeting. Take a priest in a church, a member of parliament, if you like, in parliament. Take any such situation, or father or mother or son or daughter at home, in the home, how the presence of a person affects the group. Why? How? Normal, ordinarily we say, this person has a domineering personality. But does domination over others bring happiness, health, peace? Doesn't at all. In fact, it brings violence. Domination is not love, is it? And the ways of domination are so many. Obvious, outright, brutal domination, or a more subtle domination by virtue of the fact that he's a brilliant person, a capable person, always has clear-cut views, is always successful in what he does, and what he says generally, if not always, brings a good result, and so forth. There are all those ways of domination. And there's that very, very subtle domination by being outwardly the weaker vessel. Which is a wonderfully subtle piece of humbuggery. But the person is getting his way, fulfilling his desire. So it is not that way. But the influence of the living person, who has capacity, who is in himself harmonized, healthy, he brings joy and harmony where he is. In the real sense. And we don't even know what has happened. And this is one of the hallmarks of the fact that this is true of him. He is a good influence in the truly good sense, the truly right sense. Now this is a case of love, wisdom, understanding. The non-separateness between self and not-self. What are commonly called self and not self. Then there is only the one total reality flourishing. You know how in the religions of the world we always have these accounts that in the presence of the Holy One, a wild animal is gentle. A tiger ceases to be a tiger, but behaves like a lamb in his presence. There is that remarkable story, amongst other such remarkable stories, of the wild, of the elephant, Malagiri, who was intoxicated by being given plenty of liquor by the enemies of the Buddha who wanted to kill him. And he was let loose in the street where the Buddha was walking with his begging bowl. And this elephant, being intoxicated, began to harm, to kill other people. And the Buddha says very quietly to him, this is the story, says very quietly to him, "Hello, is it worth your while doing that to these people when you are supposed to be you were entrusted with a mission against me?" And then it is stated how the Buddha so filled his mind with loving kindness and compassion that the elephant knelt down before the Buddha and made obeisance and repeated the 5 precepts which every layman undertakes. Charming story. Talking elephant, just as in the in Genesis we have the talking serpent to start with. These talking animals. But you see, it's significant, isn't it? What were they trying to teach us by this? That if you or I can fill the mind with peace, with the strength and the power of love, of understanding. And remember, love, which is not just an emotion or a sentiment or anything like that, but the reality of it. If we can do that, the whole atmosphere changes. And this is a fact, isn't it? I mean, we have all experienced it in some little way or other in our lives somewhere. So now, if from moment to moment we have to deal with the situation which is prevalent now in the world and in our own psyches, what can we, how do we sort of set about it? We can't order love. We can't go to someone and say, I want 100 weight of love, please. How much is it? And then dole out that love. Can't do it that way. What do we do? How do you fill your mind with love? With loving kindness, with compassion, with the capacity to take joy in the joys of the world. Not in the worldly sense, the sense in which man just squanders all his energies and wrecks himself and others with it. And the one and the other aspect, one of the supreme aspects of love, which is peculiar to Buddhism, and that is equanimity of mind. Complete equanimity, which will mean dispassionateness, which will mean not taking sides with anyone against another. But everyone is just included, enfolded within the wings of love. How shall we let that grow in our own being, come to full consciousness, to full light? You know how in Christian terms we say charity begins at home. Every one of us, without exception, needs no explanation of how to wish himself well. I would like to be free of enmity, malevolence, ill will, to be at ease, to be physically well, free from harm, free from all ills, and so forth. We all know that. We can all wish that for ourselves, and we know precisely what that means. Isn't that so? And we can feel this, not merely mumble so many words about it, but we can really feel it in relation to ourselves. So one can start at home. Let me put it now in the negative form rather than the positive form. In the Buddhist texts, they put it in the positive form. May I be free from enmity, malevolence, misery, ill health, and all the rest of it. But let's put it in the negative form and see what happens. Can you feel it in its negative aspect, its negative formulation? May I not be subject to ill will, malevolence, and so forth. That introduces an element of self-responsibility. I have to be awake to myself, a person, in the same manner in which I am awake to anybody else. Look at it this way, and this is the important aspect of it. Let me be free from self-hate. We all suffer from self-hate. Your kindly person suffers from self-hate in an amiable form. But he does hate himself. Consider, how are you or I conscious of wrongdoing? We know that we have done something which is wrong. One feels that one should not have done it. And the criticism which is leveled at oneself has the driving power of self-hate behind it. Now you see, if I have self-hate in me, my psychical functioning in the act of self-hating will draw upon me from outside illness, difficulty, upset, and so forth. I'm asking to be bashed. And the universe is very generous. It doles out difficulty and sorrow and pain and all the rest of it for wrongdoing. But I am contributing to bringing it upon me by self-hate. And if I can hate myself, how much easier it is to boil with moral indignation and hate the other fellow for doing what I consider wrong. Now I'm on my high horse, aren't I? Criticizing all the rest of the world. That's the devil. Off with his head at once. No, it doesn't work. Not only it doesn't work, but it simply aggravates the ill state and the ill condition. So now, this is very important to understand that in wishing the good for oneself, one is really sort of trying to ferret deep into one's inner nature and see how and where and why self-hate operates. Then you can take up the positive aspect. You wish yourself well, and you wish similarly, strongly, for your friends, for those who are dear to you. Don't wish it at first for the excessively dear one. Because in relation to the excessively dear, the psyche is full of so many demands upon that one. Reciprocal demands. Oh, my dear, I love you so much, and I do this for you, and I do that for you, and I will continue to do this, that, and the other for you. And I expect and jolly well demand that you'll do the same for me. That's there. You can't get away from it. Desire has several aspects of duality. The obvious one, the crude obvious one, is that a desire to do good which arises consciously in relation to someone or something is very often accompanied by the subconscious desire to do the opposite to that same person. There's the conflict aroused within ourselves by the uprising of desire, because we desire ambivalently. It's all very subtle, all very difficult, mind you. You have to be very wide awake and look into it. So you wish your dear one, which is much easier. You can wish somebody in whom you have real trust, without having lost your head over the person. You know how easily we hero worship. Oh, no one in the world like him or her. Well, look at the wonderful roaring business that pin-ups do. Hero worship. And what do we worship? With our heroes. Violence, sex gone awry. Sex has its rightful and indispensable place in existence. Existence cannot go on if there were no sex. But such are the ways in which all this absurdity goes on. So, the right feeling towards the one whom you respect, the one who may be a teacher, a benefactor, or whatever he is. Then move on to those who are very dear. And then on to the hostile ones. Conjure them up in your mind. This is a meditative process. When you conjure up the hostile one, be very wide awake. Because one does this as a kind of a routine technique in order to produce a result, and also in order to satisfy our egoism and vanity that I am loving my enemies to. Do good to them that hate you, or love your enemies, and all the rest of it. All this obeying of orders, this sort of obeying is a mistake. you have to understand precisely what it is all about and how you are functioning. Then it will happen in the right way. The very thing, doing good to those that hate you, loving your enemies, all that happens quite naturally then. So you have to be very careful. And then you can extend that to the whole world. Everything around you. Now look at one of the serious implications of that. If no one is your enemy, you cannot condemn anybody. Condemnation is an act of enmity. Condemnation is associated with punishment. With hurt upon another. The hurting another, the restraining another by force, can and does prevent things which are harmful to society to take place, up to a point. But there is no healing that way. The root poison which lies within our psyches is still there. The only total healing is through absolute love, which has the element of dispassion. No hate, no enmity towards anybody. It has to be completely dispassionate. Otherwise there is a self-interest involved that immediately spoils the thing. You see, we are concerned with religion, with the religious life. That means we are concerned with transcendence, with that which is the absolute, with the transcendental in the true sense. There are too many people who bandy about these words, transcendental and transcendence. You might well say, what about you yourself? Because I use the word transcendence every other minute. But I am very much awake to the fact that I do it. The others are not. And I have no interest at all. If I may use a slang phrase, I don't care two hoots about any results or consequences or anything at all. It will all happen in its own way. The world went on, the earth went on revolving and rotating before I was born, and will continue to do so after I'm dead, without the slightest alteration because of my having lived. It'll just go on. So you see, I have no sense of self-importance. There's nothing to be important about. There is no such thing as succeeding in life for me. No such thing as failing. There was, in the days when I didn't see and didn't feel the truth completely. After that, it just doesn't matter. And this is not indifference. Because if it were indifference, I would cease from doing what I do. So now, thus we can let this thing grow within ourselves. loving kindness, compassion, and taking joy in other people's advancement and so forth. And in their true happiness, the happiness which is in line with the life process. Not the happiness which makes one delirious after, 10 pints of whiskey or beer or whatever it is. That is just degradation. Nothing to do with happiness. But to take real joy in happiness everywhere. And this equanimity, this deep equanimity. This equanimity is one of the most powerful means for enabling us to absorb everything. The fellow whose poise is unshaken, whatsoever comes, he is the one who can absorb it all. And in the absorbing and in the maintenance of his compassion and his mindfulness, he effects the transformation of all that we ordinarily consider as ill.